Welcome to the Murders Monday podcast. I am Murders publisher John Rorink. We are joined by Jack Spencer, Abigail Walls, Jacob Kanzler, and Simon Schuster. Our normal host, Kamalyn, is off exploring Disney World, hopefully with his children, having a great time for a much-earned week off. I want to start with Jack Spencer because, Jack, if I remember right, a couple weeks ago, there were only two people at this table that said that presidential election wasn't over. And I think you and I were the guys.
Well, I said, I've got to correct you on that. I actually said I thought he was almost for sure going to lose. I thought he was going to come back up again and make it one more surge, but probably fall short. I was right about the surge. I was wrong, obviously, about the falling short. But who would have thought? I mean, the up and downs of this race, two people so unpopular. Who would have ever anticipated at the end we'd be questioning more the Democratic nominating process than the Republican nominating process after this thing
that
was over?
That certainly wasn't the narrative going into it and throughout the whole process.
No, I think that, again, this race was so odd and so unusual. But now when you really stop and look back at it and go, okay, how on earth did they end up picking somebody with her problems with the email stuff that they thought was put to bed over and over and over again, and then just continue to dog her and pop up? Every time you thought she was pulling ahead, it would pop up somewhere, WikiLeaks somewhere. Again, this whole race was just so... It was unrealistic what happened, and yet it's what really happened.
Mm-hmm. Jacob, when you're kind of looking at the winners and losers post-Tuesday, one of the biggest losers, if not the biggest losers, has to be the national media. There were very few voices out there that said he had a chance. There were very few voices that were kind of looking at this hinterland wealth of votes that came out for him. And there also seemed to be a lot of bias. And was it bias or was it just buying into a narrative? What do you think happened with the national media?
Well, so the media has taken a lot of flack in the post-election, post-mortem, if you will, about more or less getting the story wrong. And I guess the way to interpret that is not foreseeing a Trump victory, I guess more so. I mean, obviously painting with a broad brush, I'm sure there were some outlets out there that were, you know, covering, you know, that aspect of it. But like when we're talking about the mainstream media, it seems like one of the arguments is that the national media, any kind of media, didn't take the movement behind the Trump victory seriously. The people, the demographic that represent his supporters, that represent their sentiment, it seems like the argument out there is that media types did not get a chance to understand and fully take seriously the not just Trump, but the movement that propelled them to victory. And so,
okay, Simon, you've sort of taken a look a little bit at the straight party line voting. What did you find, and did it really help Republicans?
Well, and that's the thing, is that it seems that the straight party and keeping it on the ballot, it certainly allowed Democrats to retain their base, but it did the same for Republicans. But the problem is that Trump's victory didn't come from straight party tickets on either side of the ballot. Rather, it came from swing voters and a depressed turnout in urban centers. And I think that that's one of the major failings of the Clintons' campaign, is that they were able to get down these racial issues that they believe of social justice, but that they weren't able to intersect those with economic issues. And for the majority of America, who is not a minority, not the majority, but the plurality of America and the people who come out to vote, they heard an economic message from the Republican nominee that they weren't getting from his opponent.
Okay.
Perhaps another one of your losers, John, though, could be the Beltway conventional wisdom or political consultants, because if you look at the map of where Trump won, and where Hillary won, what you see is the focus on the conventional presidential focus on states with more electoral votes, states with more voters in the bag for each party. I mean, that map got flipped upside down. We were kind of scratching our heads at the Trump campaign going, why is he going to all these places? Why is he spending so much time in Michigan? You know, conventionally irrelevant states. But you look at the map and there was just a flood of votes. And I think that wisdom vastly underestimated the number of politically engaged and interested and passionate people in, quote, flyover country.
Jack, one of the things that shocks me, I guess, or I've been thinking a lot about over the weekend is some of the huge areas of legislative work that were accomplished in the last 4 or 5 years. I'm thinking about the expanded Medicaid program that are suddenly tossed into question based on what could happen with Obamacare. We have a lot of public policy questions suddenly in this state that are going to be popping up, don't we?
Well, we do, and one of the things that comes to mind the quickest to me is the energy package, which everybody's kind of expecting to be the hot topic in the lame duck in December. How much of that is going to be brought in? Could you, if you're arguing against it right now, could you bring into question in terms of the national changes that are going to be made on alternative energy? Are there going to continue to be subsidies for that? The whole thing on the closing of the coal plants, all this stuff that came from the Obama administration, how much of the backdrop and the reasons for some of the arguments for that, how much of those are even going to apply at this point?
Mm-hmm. So there's a good argument, or maybe there's a good case for somebody to say, wait a minute, let's hold on, let's see actually what happens at the national level, and then we can tailor our own package.
Yeah, and I think against that, you're going to have the utilities and everybody going, oh my gosh, we've gone this far, and we've gone, you know, and we're at the point where we think we can get this. We better get it right now in December, or you start really getting these questions popping up after that if it hasn't happened.
Okay. Well, certainly lots of questions to look out for this fall and into next year. We're going to next cut to a great debate between Steve Linder, head of the Sterling Corporation, and Craig Mauger, head of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network, and they're going to be debating a little bit about campaign finance. We've got some very special guests for the MERS Monday podcast. I am MERS publisher John Warnick. We are joined today by Steve Linder, head of the Sterling Corporation. Steve, welcome.
Thank you.
And Craig Mauger, executive director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. We're going to have a little debate. In full disclosure, I'm good friends with both of you. Craig used to work here. Always enjoyed his contribution to MERS. Steve Linder and I actually bought MERS together and owned it together for a while at the beginning of my career, so I've got a lot of respect for Steve. So,
you're completely conflicted.
I'm completely conflicted. I'm completely conflicted. And because of my profession, I can't give to anybody's campaign anyway. So, you know, it's all a kind of an esoteric exercise for me. But we want to address some campaign finance issues. You both have different opinions. You're both very articulate in explaining them. So we're going to kind of ask a question. We're going to get both of you to respond to it, and we'll go from there. Craig, one of the underpinning missions of groups like yours is kind of been to, you can correct me if I phrase this wrong, to kind of mitigate the impact of money on our election process. We just witnessed a presidential election where one side literally spent almost $1 million, or excuse me, almost $2 million for an electoral college vote. The other side spent $900,000 for an electoral college vote. And the lesser spending side, Mr. Trump, actually won. Doesn't that kind of shake up and dispute the need to even mitigate money in elections?
I mean, our main role is to shine light on the role money is playing in politics. I think what happened at the top of the ticket this year is a very unique situation. Donald Trump was able to leverage his ability to draw media attention to get free media attention. So he didn't have to raise the kind of money to get the attention that other candidates did. Conversely to what you said, I would argue that money in politics played a huge role in this election because a lot of the candidates were talking about it. Donald Trump was using it early on in the primaries. Bernie Sanders was talking about it. And at the same time, if you take one step down and look at the U.S. Senate races, we had 5 U.S. Senate races across this country that cost more than $30 million. 5 U.S. Senate races that each cost more than $30 million. So money was still playing a huge role in this election.
Okay. You want to react to the question?
Newsflash, money spent in politics. Here, Craig and I come from very different perspectives. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to start sort of globally. $4 billion is less than one brand of cola spends on its advertising. And I'm sorry, if people don't have the ability to see information that they're ordinarily not going to seek out among themselves, then somebody has to provide them with that information. And the way the campaign finance laws interpret the First Amendment of the Constitution. I believe all campaign finance is unconstitutional. Every part of it has been thrown out when challenged.
You mean
it's just
campaign finance regulation.
Campaign finance regulation. It's just we haven't gotten to all of it yet. And as I've said to you before, John, the First Amendment of the Constitution protects the press, protects speech, and protects religious practice. The press has exempted themselves from campaign finance. So Stephen Henderson at the Detroit Free Press can spend as much corporate money as he wants coming from who knows who to say whatever he wants, to game the press any way he wants, to endorse candidates, spending corporate money. Me, I don't have a printing press. I don't have barrels of ink. If I want to speak out about issues or about candidates, I've got to go to the government and ask for permission. I've got to, you know, make sure that every box is checked properly just for me to exercise my first right. And believe me, Craig knows. He and his buddies have been kicking my butt because wrong boxes may have been checked by an accountant. And isn't that shameful that in the exercise of our rights that certain groups get to spend as much money as they want, but the rest of us have to comply with this massive regulations and, as Craig calls it, sunshine, which is really just a way for them to prosecute their agenda to push money out of the system. So back to your original question, it doesn't matter if it's a dollar or billions of dollars. Our democracy right now with people in their busy lives deserve to have information available to them. And unfortunately, the press runs what they run. We have to even beg them to write letters, print letters or opinion pieces, and only so many and only so often. The First Amendment does give us the right to spend money to push out information. And so the fact that money is spent, the amount of money that's spent on democracy is a pittance of the size of our economy and a pittance of what people spend on soap.
Okay. Do you want to react?
Yeah, there's so much there. First off, Steve and I have fundamental disagreements about some things, and that's just how it's going to be. The amount of money in our political system is going up and up and up. Where that money is coming from, it continues to come from a smaller group, a more concentrated group. The wealth in our political system that's given is becoming more concentrated, according to all the experts looking at this. What he's talking about the First Amendment should rule all campaign finance laws meaningless and ineffective is just not the facts. A conservative Supreme Court has said we need to balance what's in the interest of society, what's in the interest of government, and the freedom of speech that we have. That's why we have campaign giving limits directly to candidates. That there is a desire among even conservative justices that there should be a balance between these two things. And it's in that balance that they've come up with this idea that we need independent spending, super PACs. We can't put caps on what's going on independently because of what the Supreme Court has ruled and how they balance these two things. The problem of that is this idea that this spending is independent is completely ridiculous. What Stephen Henderson is doing at the Detroit Free Press is independent, right? I mean, he is not coordinating with a candidate on that, right?
We have no idea. And by the way, saying that it's ridiculous, that's your opinion. Free peoples can come together for whatever reason they want, use their wealth for whatever reason they want, and speak out on issues. What these folks, Michigan Campaign Finance Network crew, all the Soros, you know, based groups.
We don't get any money from George
there.
Soros. Prove I would just say,
prove
we don't.
It. Prove
our donors are listed on our website. We
so
don't.
I don't.
There, I kept them.
Yeah. And is George Soros on there?
But
no,
he's not.
But the fact of the matter is,
everybody that goes over at what, $100?
$200.
If I want to get together myself or with my friends and say whatever I want about public policy or about a candidate's position, it's really not Craig's business.
Okay.
So are you against all disclosure law?
Well, that leads right into my next question, though.
I am for disclosure of monies that go directly to candidates, none other.
Okay, well then, how about this? The next question that I have is, this year we had some PACs that were fairly obscure, played a role in a couple of races where Democrats were attacked. They were using some of the same language the Republican Party did. We had some in another race, I believe, where it was libertarian-oriented information that was in question. Why not? I mean, why shouldn't we know if they're sending out messages and ads? Why shouldn't we know who they are? Not, I'm not questioning the right to do it, but why shouldn't we know? All right, these are the groups that are. I mean, maybe it's one organization, maybe it's two, maybe it's
the whole purpose behind this the C laws, whether it's a 501c3, a 501c4, a 501c6, was to allow people to come together and speak out, and originally was designed to protect the NAACP, so that companies and individuals who gave to the NAACP were allowed to freely associate with each other and to spend money to speak out and not have to be subject to any sort of harassment or intimidation by white power groups. Well, I'm sorry. What's good for the NAACP is good for everybody else. Let me ask you, if the Michigan Chamber, whose purpose it is to promote rules and regulations or the elimination of rules and regulations that either help or impinge commerce, if they make the decision internally to spend money, do all 10,000 members who had no input into that decision have to be outed as members? I don't think so. They give the chamber their dues money and whatever additional funds they give them for the chamber to use to protect their interests, not to subject themselves to the kind of not just disclosure, but the direct implication of corruption that groups like Craig promote. Here's an example. Craig's group just disparaged and defamed 15 good people who did nothing but work in the private sector, decide to run for office, and once they got there, use their knowledge and background about how the government skews and sometimes is a drag on particular industries. Do we want people that have never done anything in their lives to serve an office? And he accused them of conflict of interest.
Just for clarity for our listeners, I think you're referring to an October 27th article that you did with Bridge, looking at conflicts of interest between different lawmakers. Or not conflicts of interest, but I believe one was a Chevy dealer that introduced a bill pertaining to dealerships.
There was no allegation. I mean, to say that is defamation is just not true. I mean, there's no allegation.
Why did you pick them? Do you pick teachers if they vote on labor bills or teacher pensions?
Can I answer the question, Steve? I appreciate it. I mean, we said what Bridge and I did was list out situations and let the public decide. Do you think this is a conflict of interest or not? There is no statement that this is a conflict. But let the public see the light of what's happening and how these things are connected. This argument that, hey, do you pick out teachers who did this? Is there a state lawmaker serving who is currently working as a teacher as well?
I'm sure there are. But the fact of the matter is, we should appreciate the fact that people who come from the private sector, whatever that is, and are professionals, bring their experience to the legislature. And does every single legislator have to recuse themselves just because they have some personal and specific knowledge and possibly have been impacted by a law? I don't think so. You know, if you go back to the beginnings of this country, we were an agricultural society. The word lobby comes literally from the fact that the ag industry would come to the Congress and sit in the lobby so that they could talk to legislators who were also farmers and plantation, you know, tobacco plantation owners, and talk about how government policies could either help or hurt their commerce.
So you weren't really condemning the fact, like if I were owned an insurance agency, went to the House as a member and served on the insurance committee, you're not saying that there's something necessarily wrong with that.
No, we just stated that this person works in this industry and this is a bill that they introduced. Okay. I mean, that's what the piece stated. People can go read it for themselves. The argument that Steve is making was well represented in the piece, and we gave everyone the opportunity to make their arguments, to respond to it.
Do you think I just fell off the truck yesterday? When you have a headline that says, are there possible conflicts of interest, you're already putting into the minds of people that you think there is, and you chose these people for a specific reason, and I'm sorry, it was shameful and disgraceful. And a number of them who know I fight on these kinds of issues called and said, what can we do? And I said, nothing, ignore them. I don't think anybody even reads it, but yeah, I do.
I mean,
all right, we got it.
None of that's true. Okay. I mean,
we're going to agree to disagree on the article. Listeners are free to listen or free to read it. I think it's on your website.
It's on the Bridge website.
Yeah, it's on the Bridge website. It's on the Michigan Campaign Finance Network website as well. One of the issues that I always find fascinating, and even to think about, to hear people talk about, is the Citizens United case that established a free freedom of speech right for corporations. Should corporations have a right to free speech, Greg?
Should corporations have a right to free speech? I don't think that's exactly what the Citizens United case was about. The Citizens United case was about whether states or local governments, anyone, could put any limitations on independent spending in our political process by corporations or labor unions. And the Supreme Court said no, as long as it's done independently, there are no limits. The question of that case that people should be paying attention to is, what does the word independent mean? The Supreme Court had a vision that this would be completely independent of elected office holders. What Steve is attempting to describe is a process where spending is happening independent of office holders, and there's no fear of corruption. The problem is that it's not happening independent of office holders. We've seen this. There were documents leaked in Wisconsin where the governor there, Scott Walker, and his staff were basically directing contributions to different funds. There was a check that was released that in the memo line, the donor wrote, "because Scott Walker asked," as the reason for why he wrote the check. It's not happening independently. And that's the problem with the court ruling.
So he's taking a case, by the way, where everybody was exonerated. All of it was dropped. So, you know, that is dishonest. And secondly, unless you have proof, look, murder's illegal, okay? People still murder. This is a country that says, you know what, most people are honest. And we comply with the law, the letter of the law and the spirit of the law, but by God, we're not going to be silenced. Government is so big and so pervasive and so insidious that it's made winners and losers, and it's become, out of all of us, and it's been one of the largest redistributionist systems in the history of mankind. And by God, we're not going to sit here and just allow policy to be made in a vacuum. We are going to speak out, and people that have an interest in the outcome of how businesses are organized, how people's lives are affected, are going to be able to come together as free people, and they're going to speak out. To the degree that they directly interact with campaigns, there's a whole series of laws and compliance that we comply with. Independent spending to speak out and educate the public is something that we're going to fight fiercely. And by the way, the codification of Citizens United in Michigan will be done by the end of the year. So Michigan will be in compliance with the federal government.
Michigan, I mean, this might be one of your questions, but Michigan is already in compliance with Citizens United. That's a false statement that this bill is going to bring us into compliance with Citizens United. He's talking about Senate Bill 638. I encourage people who are interested in these subjects to go look it up. Michigan is in compliance with Citizens United. We cannot not be in compliance with the Supreme Court ruling. The supporters of that bill have constantly said, we're just putting Citizens United into law. This bill is not putting Citizens United into law. It's allowing lawmakers to directly fundraise unlimited contributions to super PACs. That's what this bill does. And that is not even what happens at the federal level. At the federal level, federal office holders, candidates can only raise up to $5,000 for a super PAC. So to say this is just putting Citizens United into state law is not true.
Okay. We're going to start with this question for you, Steve. And maybe this may be a very self-interested question as a journalist trying to figure out what's what. But one of the things I've noticed during my tenure is how obscurely named some of these PACs are. If you have a PAC or a leadership fund, why couldn't there be a requirement? Just simply, if Mikoff has a leadership fund, it read the Mikoff Leadership Fund, that these funds be easily tracked, whether they're PACs, whether they're leadership funds, whether they're whatever.
A leadership fund is independent, okay? Why did we name MERS MERS? Sounded good, didn't it? It's, you know, Michigan Information.
Well, we didn't name it
originally.
Huh? No,
I understand. Whoever named it, why was it named that way? I mean, to what end? It doesn't.
More accountability.
They have their own campaign funds. That is all they can control. And this is another sort of defamation and falsehood, that candidates have C4s. No, they don't. If you go look up this, go look up the C4 paperwork that's filed. Show me an elected office holder that has his own C4. He doesn't. They don't have
their own C4s. Well, what about the ones where their names are on them?
Nobody's got a C4.
Richardville Fund, Posthumous Lions Community Engagement Fund, the Forlini Community Fund.
Jones, is his name on
there? No, his is, I think, the Mid-Michigan Fund. I mean, but there are many with their names on
them.
But
they are independently run funds. They have boards of directors. They have
some
articles.
Some of the lawmaker's name is the resident agent. Yeah. I mean, there are examples of that. So, I just don't agree with what you're saying on that.
Well, the Richardville Fund was a 527, not a C4. So there's you want to create this labyrinth of regulation. You might as well get it right.
I don't remember. I thought it
was
a 517.
No, it wasn't.
For those of our listeners, including me, what's the difference?
A 527 is any political committee is a 527. For purposes of its use in Michigan, the majority of 527s are what we used to call office holder expense funds. Okay. They are funds that allow lawmakers to raise fully disclosed corporate money to underwrite the expense of serving in office. It is expensive to be a legislator. You have to buy tickets to things. You have to send staff to things. You have to drive your car. You have to buy insurance. Those are things that either the taxpayers should bear, which the taxpayers have decided they're not going to bear those expenses, or to have other people support them, and those are fully disclosed. 501c4s.
Wait, 527s are fully disclosed.
527s that are used as administrative funds are fully disclosed.
If they raise more than what? They have to raise more than $25,000 a year. So they could be raising $20,000 a year and not disclose their donors. So they're not fully disclosed. I just want to note that. And they can take money from other nonprofits.
Yeah.
And we have no idea if they're those nonprofits.
Well, those nonprofits are private organizations, and their members have a right to get together and to pool their resources for whatever the stated purpose is. The problem here, John, is what Craig doesn't like is the fact that people get together to want to try and impact the system. He wants to, through the use of what he calls shining a light, is to really bully people into not participating in these activities. This has been the ulterior but very thinly veiled motive of this organization from the beginning, is to try and shame and bully people from participating in their First Amendment right to democracy. And I'm sorry, the distinction between the press or 501c3s and 501c6 trade associations and 501c4s, everybody should have the right to freely participate in democracy. And the fact that they do should not inherently, automatically subject them to a charge of corruption.
I mean, I don't appreciate being called a bully. I haven't made any allegations. I haven't levied any name calling against Steve. He said all kinds of crazy things about me. I just don't appreciate that. But
talk a little bit about, about the mission, about shining a light. I mean, clarify from your point of view. I mean, he disparaged the whole intent of the Campaign Finance Network. I mean, give me your opinion and your understanding of the history.
By the way, they do produce good charts, and
there's an endorsement there.
Yeah.
But the mission of the Campaign Finance Network is to shine a light on the role money is playing in our political system. We're shining a light into a dark place. The role of money in Michigan's political system is a very, very dark situation.
Okay.
We don't know where millions of dollars are coming from. Our organization works to shine a light on where that money's coming from.
Well, this leads to one of my questions, because one of the accusations I've heard you make and others make about campaign finance proponents is that they're aimed at one side of the system, that they're more interested in pointing and shining a light on Republican spending than Democrat spending. Talk a little about that. How do you see your role?
Is there
much of an issue on the Democratic side as the Republican side?
It's just not true. I mean, we write about both sides. Our board members come from both sides of the aisle. We wrote a piece about libertarian mailers that were being sent out that Republicans alleged were coming from Democrats. We wrote about these robocalls that were coming from the Republican side. We write about both sides. That's what our organization does.
You want to respond to the partisan question?
Well, in my opinion, it doesn't matter whether he does it on the right or whether he does it on the left. the fact of the matter is the primary driver of this organization is to make the direct inference that money in politics is inherently corrupting. So it doesn't matter, you know, what the facts are. The fact that people spend, this organization and others like theirs around the country are going to try and convince the people that the mere fact that people want to spend money for speech, which is our First Amendment constitutional right to do it, if we don't comply with the set of rules that they lay out as being the set of rules that will completely provide assurances that it's not corrupt, then it is corruption. And that's the part that is offensive to me.
I mean, Steve's trying to make this a referendum on our organization, and I came here to debate these money and politics questions that you had. The public, they surveyed the public. You can look up any of the surveys that are out there. The public is against Citizens United. The public stands on one side of these campaign finance issues. Donald Trump has spoken out on one side of these campaign finance issues, the Republican president-elect. You know, I grew up in a city where one of the main corporations, their business is operating, was a dog food plant. That dog food plant smelled horrible to everyone in the city. It turned their stomachs. But I guarantee the people that were working in that dog food plant at the top of the executive scale, making money off that dog food plant, did not think it smelled bad. And Steve makes a lot of money off the rules that we have currently, so I understand why he wants to defend them.
All right. Well, I think that wraps up about the amount of time we've got. I enjoyed the discussion. I hope you guys did. I know it was a little tense, but hopefully our listeners learned some stuff about both your points of view and about your organization and about campaign finance. So I guess we'll wrap it up. Thanks, guys.
Hey, thanks, Jen.
Thank you.
Well, that wraps up this edition of the MERS Monday podcast. We are going to sign off today. But first, I want to thank our podcast sponsor, AT&T. I also want to thank other guys here. And Abigail, what is that cooler you've got in front of you? That is just the slickest looking thing.
Well, as you may or may not know, my birthday was like 6 weeks ago now. And for my birthday, some friends got me this Yeti. It's a thermos that keeps hot beverages hot and cold beverages cold for like 5 hours. It's pretty awesome.
I just like the name. Like Yeti. It sounds like you're like snowshoeing out in the North Pole.
Yeah. It's well, you know, it's made in Texas, and so the label on it is like, margaritas stay frozen for six. So I think that's why it's called a Yeti, for cold things.
I usually don't associate margaritas and Yetis together.
So you have a margarita in there, not cold.
John.
All right, with that, we'll sign off for the week.